Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rob Greenlee. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Good morning, Todd. It's like I keep saying, the Saturdays keep rolling by, but it's great to do the show and hop on here and talk some podcasting and new media stuff. It's always fun. I'm up in Seattle, as you can probably tell, but I'm actually going to be driving down to LA at about 1:30 this afternoon. I'm actually taking a car down to LA, so I've got a long weekend ahead of myself on the road.
Well, it'll be a nice road trip. We'll talk about that a little more here in a second. But I want to welcome our guest this morning. It's Cliff Rivenscraft from GSPN.TV, or better known as the Podcast Answer Man. Good morning, Cliff. How are you?
I have never been better, my friends. It gets better every single day. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Well, we're glad to have you on. And I tell you, it's been kind of, I was talking with Rob last show. I said, this is like show number 39 for us. And it's been an interesting ride here. We've had, a lot of, I guess for a better word, we've had a number of celebrities on over the last couple of weeks. And I told Rob we needed to start circling wagons and come back and talk to people we've talked to in the past and, get an update on really what's happening in the space, what's happening with them and so forth. And so I thought I would reach out this week and have you on, which I'm glad to have you on. But I tell you, Rob, so I do want to go back to a quick point here. You said you're headed down to LA. So are you going to get an apartment down there now or something? Or are you, what's the plan?
Yeah, that's a whole drama story in itself. But I've been trying to find like a room share situation down there. I haven't been successful yet. There's been lots of opportunities that have kind of come and gone and stuff. I guess because it's a pretty popular area, kind of that Beverly Hills area, where it's difficult to find places. But I've been staying in Airbnbs every single week down there, and that's what I'm doing this coming week as well. I'm trying to establish a little bit more of a regularity down there because it's staying at a different place every week I go down. Driving a rental car for 3 or 4 days of the week is kind of getting old. So I want to create a little bit of kind of familiarity with my kind of life down there, where I just hop on an airplane, go down there. It's just like commuting to work, right? And
then
just, all the stuff is kind of the same, and I have the same routines and things like that. It's just a lot more streamlined.
Staying at doing the thing where you're finding the houses. You said Airbnb. What? Why aren't you just racking up the old hotel freaking flyer miles? Is it cheaper?
I mean, really, honestly, it's a lot less expensive to stay at an Airbnb than it is to stay in a hotel. Cause down there in LA, you have to pay for parking, and parking is like almost $40 a night.
Right.
So it really adds up. I mean, you could easily spend $200 a night, easily down there. And I can stay at an Airbnb for like $90 a night. So
yeah, it makes sense. So
it's like half, but it also comes with a price too. You have to, you have to adjust to the person that you're staying with, because it is like, taking on a new roommate every time you go down there, and stay for 3 or 4 days. So,
well, you're definitely getting a sampling of the cross section of, LA, aren't you?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. But it's very, very focused on just that kind of area of Beverly Hills. So it's, I try and stay as close to the office down there, because if you get too far away from anything down there, you get caught up in that whole traffic thing, and traffic is just a nightmare down there.
Yeah, well, that's why it's one of the largest commuting, cities in the country. People sometimes have no choice just because of cost of everything as well. But anyway, good luck with your drive, and that's a pretty drive though.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Wave to the Silicon Valley as you go through, because I used to live in actually not Silicon Valley, but San Joaquin Valley. Wave to that as you drive through, because I used to live down there in the 90s. For a few years.
Oh, you did? Okay, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, when I was active duty, I lived in Lemoore, and most people don't know where Lemoore is.
There's a lot of small towns that I'm going to be driving through all the way down there. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
All right, cool. Well, anyway, Cliff, I heard you are building a new house. I saw something on your Facebook feed a while back.
I saw that too.
Yeah, it's going extremely well. We should be in by May 5th, and it's currently in the framing stage, so it's pretty sweet. I have been dreaming of a new studio space outside of the four walls that I'm sitting in right now for quite some time. And in my new house, the actual studio is the same square footage of the living square footage of the house I'm in now. So wow. It's going to be a bit bigger.
Wow, that's really, really cool. You know, I was last night I was hanging a little bit with my wife's cousin, and he is he got trained by some great ukulele masters here in Hawaii, and now he has his own studio. And you know, this is, you guys are going to kind of laugh about this, but you know, he's got 240 ukulele students, and you know, he's talking about the four rooms they're training in and his waiting area, telling you about a setup for a studio. And I said, "How big is this thing?" He says, "Oh, it's 600 square feet." And I'm like, "Wow!" You know, you got four classrooms and a waiting area and all that compacted into 600 square feet. And he says, "Yeah, that's the only thing I can afford." And I understand it completely, because you know, I've tried many times to find a space here, and anything bigger than about a 10 by 10 area, kind of, and this is my studio, here's a 10 by 12, which is, you know, entirely too small, but, you know, we've dealt with it for many, many years. You know, you start right out at like subleasing at, you know, $1,000 a month, and, you know, that can vary. And if you get much bigger than that, you know, it's 2,000, 3,000, you know, the square footage cost here is just absolutely incredible for even the absolute worst location. So it's you know, I think I'm stuck where I'm at for now. We had talked about actually renting trying to find an apartment that had an open wall and basically an open floor plan, and actually it would have been cheaper. We feel it's cheaper to rent an apartment than to try to find some commercial space to put a studio in, because you can get more bang for the buck. And you know, I'm sure that's a lot. Well, you know, a lot of folks want to expand their operations and just can't. Yeah. They're constrained, you know. So I'm happy for you.
Yeah. Well, the thing is I live in Northern Kentucky, and we have plenty of places where there's new development. So we're building our house, and the basement is the lower level of our home is 1,200 square feet, and that will be all 100% all my business.
Nice.
So to have 1,200 square feet is going to be very nice. And one of the things that is a part of this pipe dream in my future is that I'm going to have my own little late night internet show where people will be flying into Cincinnati. They'd be a part of my my own little version of like Late Night with Jimmy Fallon and stuff like that. So who knows?
Well, sounds like a lot of fun, and you know, and it's part of a burgeoning business. You know, you're looking forward, figuring out what you're going to do in the future, which is good. And I think that's important. I think all of the, you know, content creators, you know, I've got a 10-year plan, and we sit down every January and map out where we were. You know, we basically, you know, do comparisons of where we've been in the past and where we want to go. And it's hard in a space to plan 10 years, but you kind of have to do it. So what's new with you? What's going on with your network? And you know, I guess we'll start there.
So you're talking about are you asking me that?
Yeah.
So the network, you know, GSPN.TV, when I first left my career in insurance, I thought, you know, GSPN is where I was going to make all of my money, and I was going to create content and pursue the actual, you know, my own production of my own content as a career. And, you know, a lot of different other opportunities started to pop up all over the place as I started to move in that direction. Right now, things are primarily focused in the area of Podcast Answer Man and actually the consulting and coaching angle of things, and not necessarily as much on my network of shows that my wife and I produce. Although we still do Family from the Heart every single week. I still produce Pursuing a Balanced Life on a regular basis, but and we do have one entertainment podcast that's going on right now, the Veronica Mars fan podcast, but that's something we just do for fun. We don't do any of those shows, Family from the Heart, Pursuing a Balanced Life, the Veronica Mars podcast. None of that is actually pursued for monetary gain of any nature, while that has changed over the years, because previously we did pursue you know, monetization of those products or of those shows, and we're successful at it. But I became more successful at finding other ways to monetize the kind of producer to at least create a business around one specific show, which is Podcast Answer Man. And things that have changed recently is that, of course, my podcasting and consulting, as you know, Todd, and Rob knows as well, it actually got me to the place where I was the director of podcasting for New Media Expo, which is a position I just recently resigned from after 2.5 years, just so that I could free up some extra time and pursue some new goals in my business. Another thing that I had done is I had created a mastermind organization and ran it for 2 years called the Podcast Mastermind, which I just also just recently shut down. And that was something that had generated $57,000 in income last year. And I completely quit it cold turkey and shut it down and explained to the world why I did that. But one of the things that has been the biggest generator of income is last year in 2013, I made over $200,000 training small groups of 20 to 30 students how to podcast every other month. And that's my podcasting A to Z course. And that's what I've been primarily focused on, selling podcast equipment and digital training tutorials. And I've decided in 2014 that I want to continue my focus on podcasting A to Z, continue creating new training tutorials, selling more equipment, and also doing some live training events. And once I get into my new studio space, not only will I have room for an actual set and some other kind of really cool things, but I also will have a classroom space, if you will. I mean, it's the best way. Rather than trying to go over to the, you know, the local hotel down the road and reserving one of their rooms to hold a little mini conference for, you know, 30 people, I can, in my new studio space, I can actually set up little mini tables with chairs and actually have an instructional class over the weekend for 15, 20 students, even 30 students if I want to. So those are the kind of things that I'm doing.
That's cool. And so the consulting part of the business obviously is grown and sustaining your livelihood, which is fantastic. You know, I think what I see, and I've actually had to dial back from consulting just because I was doing too much. So now I'm picking and choosing, you know, that at least for the company is picking and choosing the corporate clients we want to, because we've never, you know, we've done mostly corporate clients and then one-on-ones. We don't do at least I haven't done groups, so it is a little bit different of a community. But it is nice to be able to pick and choose a little bit on who you work with as well. It's just for at least for me, it's been a little bit of a freeing experience. Rob, you know, I know that you've watched Cliff over the years and what he's doing, and you know, what's your gang. Let's just go. I'll just turn it over to you. I'm not
sure.
I'm not thinking straight. I woke up late this morning.
That's fine. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like Cliff, you're getting so busy. I mean, you were doing a lot of different things, and I can totally see why you would kind of narrow it down and focus to a really solid training course that was a good model for you to actually be able to pull a regular trigger on, because it sounded like that was the course that you really were really focused on all along, and you had these other things going on. So I really commend you for the focus. I think it's fantastic. And I keep, you know, seeing and hearing, and I listen to your podcast, and you offer some great advice to people, and you're having an impact. I am curious about, you know, the whole New Media Expo topic, and I don't know if you can talk a lot about that, but I would certainly love to hear a little bit more detail on, you know, on who's going to take that over. Is there any plans yet? And is there anything, you know, any kind of afterthoughts of the whole New Media Expo that you can share with us?
Well, I do know for a fact that there's nobody lined up for taking my position yet, although I'm sure that they will want to find somebody. The podcasting track, you know, in my own opinion, was really I believe it was probably one of the most exciting features of January 2014 event. I think the podcasting track really was the life force. I think it had the most energy and everything going with it. I was very excited to see, you know, have all the support that I had from New Media Expo, the staff over there, to really give me what it took to actually do the things that I felt would be necessary to make, you know, that event a home for podcasting. With that being said, you know, I felt like I was the lone ranger over there trying to make all this stuff happen. And, you know, if it were my conference and if, you know, if it were something that was actually what my career aspirations were, which was to actually own that conference or move that to make that conference and my income from it a primary source of income for me, I would continue to pursue that, but it's not. It was actually something I did on the side. And, you know, I'm very thankful for my time there because of it did give me a lot of great exposure. I don't necessarily believe that I had to have the credibility, but it certainly added a lot of credibility to who I am in the community outside of the circles that I ran in. So I'm very excited about all of that. With that being said, I think New Media Expo, there are still a couple things, and I feel like I can say this on the record, there are still a couple things about New Media Expo that don't necessarily fit with and line up with my own personal feelings about, you know, the representation of where the podcasting community can be as a professional space. I represent my circles, the people that hire me, the people who train me, they're small businesses, they're medium-sized businesses, they're professional solopreneurs, they're coaches, they're lawyers, they're doctors, they're nurses. These are the people out there who are hiring me, and they're extremely professional people. And, Todd, tell me if I go too far off the deep end, but
I think you're okay.
You know, in NYC 2012, there was an event that they held called New Media Live. And on the stage, they brought in this web TV girl. And her claim to fame was this YouTube video that got a ton of hits, and they actually showed it from the stage, which was her mixing cake batter with this female pleasure device. I'll just leave it at that.
And oh, jeez.
And during that event, by the way, I had invited a lot of business associates to come to NYC with me, and as a result of that, them coming and saying, "Cliff, yes, we'll come to this conference that you're helping put together for the podcasting track." I got a lot of flack for that. I got a lot of flack for some of the keynotes were there. And, you know, each year there's always something going on with the keynotes. And, you know, it was a little bit of a place where it's very clear that New Media Expo and some of the keynotes seem to be more geared towards what I would consider my college fraternity days. And not necessarily my business professional days. And so, you know, the more and more I would invite the professional, very top, my closest of closest associates that really can bring a lot of amazing credibility and stuff like that to the conference, the keynote experiences weren't always in line with, you know, what those people are in line with, if that makes sense. So that certainly played a little bit of a factor there. I'll leave it at that.
Now, they did make an announcement earlier in the week that they're going to have a pavilion at NAB. And Rick had actually called me and asked me about it and talked to me about it. And they're going to have a 50 by 50 pavilion for media creators, bloggers, and so forth at NAB over outside in North Hall. Real close, Rob, to where we had our live broadcast studio. It's going to be inside the door there at N4. And I'm not going to be able to go to NAB because actually it's one of the few consulting gigs I've picked up this year that I've decided to do. I'm going back to the year area in Seattle to do a 1 week deal inside a business. But so I don't know if that's a sign that they're moving New Media Expo to align it with NAB. I don't know. Rick hasn't said anything yet. If I was a guessing man, I think that would be the case. And I think it would be smart to move it away from that early January timeframe. You know, for us, and that's something I've always told, I've told Rick this and publicly, is that, you know, the value for us is meeting new customers. And being able to justify the amount of money we're going out there and spend and take from that show, take business away. And what it's been for the last two or three years for us, at least, is a more of a, hey, waving the flag, hey, we're still here and meeting up with people. But as a business, that doesn't add to my bottom line. And I have to go to a, you know, support shows that add to my bottom line. I don't know, the podcast community did not just, you know, they may went to the sessions, but they definitely avoided the, a few would go on to the show floor and say hello to the vendors, but for the most part, most didn't. And, trade show is not a trade show without the people on the floor. So, So what does that mean? Does it mean it just needs to be, you know, take the trade show out of it and just have the conference portion? You know, is that what we have to go to? I don't know.
Well, it does kind of feel like that the podcast movement event is moving a little bit that direction, right? It's not the exhibition part is not a big focus of the event. There's going to be some exhibitors there, but it's certainly not really the focus. I agree with the comments about the this past year specifically with the keynotes and things like that. Though I have to say that some of the keynotes were actually really, really good too. So
I do want to say that, Rob, that they did improve this year. This year was Scott Stratton was amazing this year. Leo Laporte did a wonderful job there. And also there was a shared keynote with Lynette Young. I mean, there were some great keynotes this year. So it's definitely something that's improving. But of course, there was one keynote this year that was a little off the edge.
Oh my God. Yeah. And it actually ran up against my event. I was losing my mind. About had a meltdown.
It was not professional.
No. Not at all. Now, I guess, you know, and Rob and I have been very open about talking in the podcast movement. I know that you're going to be doing one of the keynotes over there, but we were, I guess for a better word, I am highly disappointed in, you know, and you excluded, I'm highly disappointed in the lineup of keynotes at Podcast Movement. They've got two entrepreneur podcasters that are going to be talking, people I've never heard of, ever. And we know who Evo is, but I don't know what Evo's actually even doing in the podcasting space these days. And, you know, you're the only one that I would consider to be an active content creator that's on that keynote list. So, you know, I really think that they haven't reached out to some of the great movers and shakers that are doing incredible things in the podcasting space. Now, I know it's year one and they've got some challenges, but, some challenges in asking people and trying to build hype. But, we've publicly talked to them as well, but I don't know. We'll see how well they do with the event, and I guess I'll just not go to at least two of these keynotes because I just cannot handle these entrepreneur type folks that are selling crap. Yeah. You know
the for me, what the podcast movement looks like at this point is it's like the next stage of what a PodCamp Dallas would be. I know that they're calling it a national podcast conference, and it certainly, you know, is a, you know, a for-profit venture. So it has a lot different feel from the, you know, the grassroots unconference feel of PodCamp. But it really, I mean, knowing that just the experience of the people who are putting the conference together, you know, it's about the same level of experience who usually would organize and put a PodCamp together. It's nothing. I'm not saying anything negative. That's just the facts of, you know, I'm going to come away. I'm going into the podcast the podcast movement conference expecting it to be hopefully one of the more in the realms of a more well-run PodCamp experience, one of the more popular experiences of a PodCamp. And one thing that I do like about it is that it's not so, you know, let anybody speak. You know, it's they are choosing people and picking and choosing, and there's a little bit of curation of who is going to speak there. I certainly understand where you're coming from on that. The reason why I'm involved and why I decided to get involved is, you know, I'm in this space of the podcast Answer Man, right? This is, you know, the the list of speakers, including the keynote speakers and certainly the other list of speakers who were on this Kickstarter page. I mean, there's a lot of people in that circle who are in the circles that I typically run in. Not necessarily the most popular podcast, although there are a couple in there. They're certainly very popular in the niche that I'm in. So when I saw that they had on there, you know, they did something unique and different in the space by funding a conference starter, or at least getting it started. You know, I thought it was interesting, and there seemed to be enough buzz about it that it's like, you know, I don't want to regret not being in the space where so many of the people in my circles in the podcast community are coming. And so that's why I'm a supporter of it and why I want to go to the event. And I do believe, and this is the most exciting thing for me, I do believe the podcast movement is going to bring a good number of people who are just interested in podcasting but haven't yet started yet. And of course, you know, I'm a business person too myself. And, you know, a lot of people are going to go there. They're going to decide to do podcasting. And of course, I love that, not just for business, but also I love seeing the industry as a whole grow with each new podcast that gets.
Yeah, I just hope they can keep the pitching down, because, you know, that's something that people, you know, go to a conference. You don't go to a conference to get pitched. You go to a conference to learn something. So as long as they're, you know, they put some strict rules in place with everyone saying, hey, you know, don't be pitching. But, you know, I know it's hard to control. Rob, did you want to say anything about this at all, or about the?
Yeah, I mean, I got involved just purely from the position that I think that the podcasting space needs its own, you know, it needs its own conference, it needs its own event where we can start doing like what we used to have with the Podcast Expo. We can start building some community and some focus. I mean, with the New Media Expo, we've always been kind of like a bolt on to the conference, and it hasn't really felt like it's been, you know, all about what we want to focus on. And so purely from that, I think it's a opportunity. I think I'm thinking about it more for year two and year three than I am for year one.
Yeah, me too.
I think it's what the event could be. I do like the fact that it's kind of in the middle of the country, which could pull from both coasts. There's a lot of podcasters on the East Coast as well as on the West Coast. So, to be able to have a central location like that, I think could work well. So I'm hopeful that this event could turn into be, like we've talked about here, a real professional podcast event that we can actually get there. A lot of the biggest podcasters in the space. And I don't believe that we're going to accomplish that in year one. Just based on what I see in the lineup, there's a whole nother part of the podcasting space that isn't even involved in any conference. I'm not 100% sure why that is. It's more the really big podcasters, the big celebrities, the big comedians. Though I would say that the only other event that comes to mind is the LA Podcast Festival, which brings out a lot of the celebrity comedian side of podcasting that typically these conferences, I mean, like the Podcast Movement and the New Media Expo doesn't basically attract. So I think that there's some combination of sharing of contacts or whatever that can happen between the LA Podcast Fest guys and the Podcast Movement to try and bring those two events together, you know, in a sense. So anyway, I think it's great. I think it's really important that the space kind of come together more and share. And I agree with both of you guys 100% on what, you know, your comments about it as well.
And I have a question for you guys to take this question a step further. One of the things that I know all three of us here are aware of, and that is the history of the actual original Berkman Brothers podcast conference. That was the Podcast Support Meetable, you know, whatever, all the different names. And then how over a course of a couple of years, they decided to actually sell the rights of that conference to New Media Expo, to Blog World at the time. And you guys, we're all three aware of that history. And because of the history and one of the you know, a lot of the conversations, one of my goals when I was the director of podcasting is that I really wanted to podcasting be a part of an industry conference where there's one event every single year, not two, but one event every year where every podcaster could call home. And that was a part of my vision. That was a part of what I was trying to do. And I was trying to pull people together from all these different places, specifically, you know, some of the bigger people, trying to get them in, getting the fiction podcast community in, trying to pull everybody together where this is that one place. If you wanted to go and meet podcasters, other podcasters, no matter what sphere they're in, this is that one event every year. And so that was my vision. And then my first reaction to the podcast movement was, this is a horrible thing. And I'm not afraid to say that. That was my first, is like, oh my gosh, this is so against the vision that I had. And the reality, you know, it took me a little bit to actually sit down and think through that. And the fact is it's, you know, there's been podcamps there, and you just mentioned the LA podcaster event that's gone for a couple of years now. So I'm trying to figure out in my own mind, is it important for us to have an industry trade event where it one event where everyone goes to, or does it benefit the podcasting community and industry as a whole to have a lot of events, even a lot of national events that cater to specific niches within the podcast community? And that's why ultimately, you know, it's like, you know what? I think that I do want to support the podcast movement because I think the podcasting space is big enough that it can do this. And what really convinced me was the fact that if you look at blogging, there are a ton of different, there are mommy blogger events, there's financial blogger events, there are, you know, all kinds of different blogging events. So why not podcasting? So what do you guys think about that?
No, I 100% agree. And I think we're kind of seeing the early stages of that. I mean, if you look at the LA Podcast Fest, that's really a where all the comedians go. So, and then the podcast expo that we've been, you know, all of us have been participating in takes another section of the community. And I think that the podcast movement, and I'm not exactly sure what section that's going to really focus on, I think it has a lot of the same people that go to the New Media Expo going to that. So I'm not sure that we are entirely kind of broken up like that. Though I have to say, I do know that there's podcast events that go on at the down in San Diego at Comic-Con. And those are, you know, podcasts that focus on, you know, movies and TV shows and other types of things, you know, in the kind of geek and literature space. So I think that we have seen those types of things, and those things are active today. But you're right, Cliff, it's kind of early days for that somewhat.
And I think in order to have an event that vendors will support, you have to have some, you know, you got to get the numbers up, you know. So I think, you know, all these little separate little community events that people have are great, but, you know, how do you get the vendors to show up to, you know, and maybe you don't want the vendors to show up. Maybe you just want to have a conference, but, you know, I think, you know, from being on the vendor side of things, we want an event that we can go to and reach content creators, you know, and not the same folks. I, you know, we love to see the old folks. We love to see folks that have been in the space, but we got to grow the space. We don't, you know, and it's growing, but most of the people that are growing are not coming to any of these events. You know, we've got a large number of people that are entering the space every day, and but I don't think they're, you know, and it's kind of interesting too. It seems to be bloggers have been more willing to spend money on their trade than podcasters are. It's pretty kind of crazy if you think about it, because
I'll challenge that. You know, because I've certainly heard that. I heard a lot of people tell me that there's no way, Cliff, you can make a living as a podcast consultant. You should be a new media consultant. And I will tell you, the average client of mine spends between $2,500 to $5,000 to launch their podcast. And that, and I deal with about 500 of those people every single year right now.
No, you know, what you need to do, Cliff, then is come out with some comparison studies, and just for your business standpoint, to find out where your average, you know, how your success rate is for those folks that start too. That'd be a cool thing to see as a sub note. You know, I think that that's the exception and not the norm.
But it's also a very clear direction of mine to try to reach it. See, I don't know if you would consider me a vendor as much as I am a trainer or a coach. I don't have an ongoing recurring revenue stream from these folks that are signed up with me. But as somebody who makes a living from teaching people who want to get into podcasting, the one thing I would do is I literally go to conferences that aren't podcasting related, and I don't go as a vendor at an expo hall. I've never set up a booth anywhere, but what I do is I go and I speak, and I don't do pitches. I actually go and talk about the joys and benefits of podcasting and what it can be to you as a brand new entrepreneur at, let's say, Michael Hyatt's platform conference. And here are 7 reasons you should have a podcast within the next 90 days. And at the closing of that talk, and here's how you can do it for free. And here are some other resources you can look into. But I always point people to a free resource that is absolutely will cost them nothing. But if you want to be taken seriously, you want to probably see this as an investment, just like you would investing, you know, getting, you know, listed in the Yellow Pages years ago. Having a podcast today can be just as beneficial, if not more. So basically for me, what I'm doing is I'm actually going out and reaching people who aren't looking for podcasting, but actually who very much need podcasting.
Right.
And that's where I've been going. And I find these people are very much interested in investing in it, way beyond some of the people who are quote unquote looking into it.
So it's more business people. It's not individuals that are starting individual shows then largely.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or the individuals that I'm working with are individuals who are leaving career as a graphic artist and actually launching out into their own business of being a graphic artist, or a photographer who's launching out to be a freelance photographer. You know, they're doing it on their own now.
Right.
So those are the people that I'm working with. And those people, by and large, do see it as investment and are investing. And so that's I could see you guys going to conferences, not just hitting the podcast, you know, the podcast focused conferences, but actually hitting the people who should be podcasting.
But as a company, I can't do that. I have to go as a vendor, you know, because I'm, you know, if I'm going, I have to go as a vendor. It's not where I'm going as a business. It's, yeah, you know, if you're going for me, I can't go to an event. And, you know, if you go to CES and you try to pitch your wares, pitch your business, and CES catches you without being a vendor, they escort you off the property. So being a speaker is a different situation. That's if you're there as a speaker, you know, you can make people are going to know who you are and they're going to look you up. And that definitely in itself is its own self-fulfilling type of, and that's completely good. But if I go to an event, you know, Rob, I don't know. It's difficult to, you know, those are for me to go to an event where it's not podcast related. To me, it doesn't, I don't know. I'm not going to gain the 500 customers I need to gain to have paid for the event, you know?
Yeah. No,
I see. That's where I think you should be the speaker and go and be the keynote speaker in an author convention.
At a what convention?
An author, like book writers.
Okay. Yeah, that's water. We're 8 years old on that. So,
hey, I wanted to mention one thing too. I mean, we've been kind of talking around this topic, but I was talking to Tom Webster from the Edison research side, and on Friday, and we were just bouncing around and talking about kind of the whole podcast space and what the trends are that he's seeing. And one comment, and I got some clarity from him on one topic that I thought was really interesting. I've been thinking about this for many years, is that the whole trend line of the name podcast and its awareness. I know there's been a lot of talk about you know, do we maintain podcast, you know, as a name? And I think that that ship has sailed. But one comment that he made in context of that, he fully agrees that the podcast name is here to stay and there's no issue with that. But as you think about it, the name awareness is at like, I think, 44%, and it's been like 42-44% of the U.S. population is aware of the name podcast. And his comment was we are still – see, I've been worried about, you know, building that up into the 50s and 60% of the U.S. population being aware of the name podcast and how's that – translates into people actually consuming podcasts. You know, because I think that one of the biggest areas of things that we need to think about as an industry is growing the overall audience of listeners, right? Because we're all fighting over, you know, the same listeners right now. But his comment was is that at like 44% of the U.S. population, that's actually a lot of people. But the podcasting space is still not as far as people being aware of the name versus people that are listening to podcasts, we're still well under 44%. So it's ramping up. And at some point in the next couple of years, the awareness and the consumption of podcasting are going to kind of match up at some point. So we're still in the growth curve, but the perception is that the name is flat, right? There's no growth in overall awareness of the name podcast that can then translate into consumption of podcasts. So I think there's a couple things going on. One is that oftentimes people consume podcast content and don't even realize they're consuming podcast content. So there's this other dynamic that's going on as well. But we need to keep charging up the hill of converting people that are aware of the concept of podcasting and type of content that's there. And then once we kind of reach some level of where the awareness kind of line is, then we can start building something where we're actually growing the awareness. And my question to you guys is, what do you guys think? And I know I've mentioned this before somewhat. What do we need to do to break through that 44% of awareness of podcasting just in general? To really build this audience? And I know it's a complicated question, but I was just trying to get your guys' feedback on that topic.
I'm currently underway right now in a media blitz on trying to take the understanding of podcasting to the next level. Basically, there are more stories in the USA Today and New York Times about podcasting in 2013 than there ever had been previously. And so I don't know. I think Tom Webster's last update of the stats was 2012. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong.
No. He actually pushed out a study called The Infinite Dial. Just got pushed out last week.
So it has 2013 numbers?
I believe he has 2014 numbers.
Okay.
He's pushed out more recent stuff. So if you go to the Edison website and look for the Infinite Dial research, you can get the latest numbers on that.
Well, I'll check that out. But I do know that for what I'm seeing is that the number of times that there's an article out there in the USA Today and in the mainstream press, then those people are actually emailing me and saying, hey, did you see this article? Did you see this article? And I actually get more of those notices now than I've ever seen in the past. And so I know that mainstream people who haven't heard of podcasting are seeing at least the term podcast in the actual title, a headline of those articles. So I see that happening. And I'm currently working with somebody who's a media person who's getting me some coverage. And I was just interviewed for Cincinnati Business. What is it called? It's a major publication here in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm currently in waiting to hear from my local WCPO Channel 9 news station, and I also have the possibility of maybe having something that has WSJ as initials potentially in the very near future as well. So, you know, I think that one of the things that we can do is take our stories that we have, and which I believe are newsworthy, and go out and find the press that are always on the lookout for different angles to share and tell our story to people. I think there are a lot of people who I've learned that there are a lot of people who are interested in hearing about a guy who in 2005 started a podcast about a TV show Lost and has turned it into a business that made over $500,000 last year. So those kind of things, you don't have to have that kind of a story, but you can still tell your story. I know my friend, who was it? It was Anna Sophia Reinhart, who created the Fighting Anorexia podcast. And just her story of seeking recovery and creating a podcast where she's helping thousands of people around the world seek recovery for anorexia. She went out and had an entire, she took the advice that I had and had a news station come out and interview her, do a documentary. She was featured in a multi-page magazine article in Switzerland. These are the kinds of things that we can do. And so I encourage every podcaster out there, if you've been podcasting for a while and you've had any kind of cool results from that, contact your local newspaper, your local TV station, and see if you have any connections whatsoever to some of the other mainstream major press and get your news out there.
You know, Rob, far as the podcasting word goes, you know, and maybe my circle runs different, but, you know, I'm out and about a lot. And I don't think I've run into anyone in the last 2 or 3 years that doesn't know what podcasting is. You know, I know they did the survey, but I don't know. I think I see pretty broad understanding of the word. So and people understand what the space is. But I also know that, you know, a lot of shows call themselves a show and people are getting that content, yeah. You know, and they're technically a podcast, but they're, you know, they're doing a show. One thing, Cliff, I would love to see. As all these podcasters are claiming to make $500,000 worth of show, I'd like to see a certified copy of their tax return put online.
By the way, that's fine. And you know, go to podcastanswerman.com/income. My W-2 form is actually on there for 2013.
Okay, so I'm not saying you, but some of these other shows.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, and by the way, mine's not from my podcast, by the way. You know, I decided I wasn't going to try to monetize the podcast. I was going to monetize the business that was built based upon the exposure that my podcasting gave to me.
Yeah.
And so
I guess it's been
my interesting. Business revenue last year was $512,000 and my personal income was $279,000 last year. And my income forms are on podcastanswerman.com/income.
I would, I'm not doubting your numbers, but I would like to see all these podcasters are claiming these numbers to put a CPA certified stamped because it's true because, you know, I write checks every day to podcasters and I know what they're making.
Now I know who you're talking about, and I agree. That would be interesting to see those certified. That's I didn't even think about that, but maybe subconsciously that's why I actually scanned the front page of my whatever form.
So
there are some that I've heard a six-figure income per month kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It's definitely possible.
And
I do know that there are podcasters out there that are making a lot of money doing podcasting.
Ones that make six figures are few per month. No. Are few and far between.
And by the way, I think it's very possible to have a six-figure income month with a product launch. And I think that the person that we're all three thinking of at the same time, I would say that that person probably did make a six-figure income in 1 month with a launch. But I happen to know that there's one particular launch that was a one-time price that you pay for lifetime membership. That's not a monthly recurring revenue.
That's right.
So while it's very impressive, and I congratulate anybody who has a six-figure income month.
Yeah.
Please, folks, when you hear somebody has a six-figure income month, don't go around and then say, well, gosh, so-and-so is making $100,000 a month.
Right.
That's not there. Those are two different statements.
That's true. And, you know, and then there's also another aspect of it is those are gross numbers. Those are not net.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah, there, yeah. There's.
Well, that's true.
When you're making that much money, there is definitely cost associated.
Yes. So yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think that the big celebrity podcasters are taking, you know, ads are doing really well, yeah. But they also have staffs and teams that produce their shows and you know, the infrastructure that it takes to have a show like like the Adam Carolla show is a good example, is pretty expensive. Yeah. But you know, a show like Adam's doing generates a lot of revenue and a lot of sponsors but yeah, just like you talked about, there's also a lot of costs associated with having a show at that level too.
And usually the shows that here, you know, this is the kind of thing that's been funny to me, is that the shows that I know are making six-figure incomes, they never talk about it. They never ever talk about money. And you know, and I, matter of fact, I had one guy that still does very well even today. He told me, he said, don't ever even hint how much money I'm making, because if my boss found out, I'd be out of a job. You know, so, you know, he was, you know, his situation was, I don't, you know, this, you know, my, as far as my boss knows, this is my little hobby. And what I'm pulling down each month is none of his or anyone else's. And we would never obviously reveal anyone's income level. Yeah. But usually the shows that are making the money, you know, you're like, if I listed off the list of names, you'd be like, huh? Huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who?
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of shows out there that that is private, right. Private information. Yeah. I would never share that either. Yeah. But you know, I'm managing the back end technology, right, for a show like Adam Carolla now. Yeah. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a daunting challenge. I mean, it's a huge operation that he has and
huge, know, overhead.
The Steve Austin show and all this stuff are all on our platform. You know, and a lot of other big shows. So it's, you know, it's an interesting place to be at, you know, when you're playing in the space at that level. It's a lot more complex than what it might appear to look like. You know, it's just this little icon on iTunes, but what goes on behind all that is pretty extensive.
And, you know, and some people are obviously using their shows to promote their businesses, and some of the claims they can make is on their business, you know, anything is, that's real easy too, but you know, if you take the blogging, you take, podcasting, you take all the social media stuff you do, maybe advertising, whatever you're doing for your regular business. And then, you know, let's say they have that business and they add the podcasting element. It's real easy for someone to say, well, I had a $300,000 year because of my podcast. Well, you also had all this other stuff in place before. Podcasting helped maybe drive some new business. But I don't think there's very many podcasters that can say my podcast alone was the result, and if they're not doing advertising, my podcast alone was the result of me making X number of dollars. There'll be some exceptions to that, of course.
Some exceptions.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I can tell you, and if that entire blog post, by the way, I started in 2012. It's had two or three updates since then. The one that I've mentioned a couple of times, I won't self-promote it anymore.
That's okay.
They can go back and listen.
On this show, you can.
All right. Well, it's podcastanswerman.com/income. But if you go, like, for example, I will say this, is that I think it was 2010, I brought in $28,000 directly from nothing more than people who were paying for the content. So it was a number that I remember off the top of my head.
Right.
And then I don't have the numbers in front of me. I could pull up the post, but I mean, affiliate commissions were directly the result of the thing. I've had sponsors who have paid. I'll just say that I had one sponsor who paid $200 an episode for every episode of a weekly podcast for 4.5 years. So, and by the way, that podcast never had more than 1,000 subscribers.
Right.
But by the way, there was several months where on average, it generated about $7,000 worth of sales. And there were some months when it was in, like, you know, $23,000-$24,000 in sales for them during Christmas and times like that. So, I mean, it is possible, but it is an exception. And, and you have to do some. By the way, when I was doing that, I was creating 7 to 15 podcast episodes a week, and I was massively trying to build relationships with literally not just hundreds, but thousands of people. And that takes a lot of work. And I was working 14 to 18 hours a day, seven days a week.
And, you know, and that's an important aspect is, and we can move away from money. This is, it's, if you're going to do, you know, it's okay to do a show part-time and do a great show part-time. There's, you know, a lot of great shows that people do part-time. But it's hard work. It's not easy. This is something you have to, you know, you have to put a lot of time in. And I think a lot of people, I think people understand it more now than they did before. But, you know, it definitely is not, you know, if you do the division, you know, Cliff, if you do the math on some of those early years and you look at your time versus how much you made, how much you actually worked per hour, you know, you might be get a little depressed, and then I was actually, and you change, and then you change your business model, you know, and now you're able to say, okay, I'm going to hyper focus on this week of doing my consulting. It's going to bring X number of dollars in. I'm actually, and I've always from day one of doing my own show, you know, at the end of the month, I say, okay, how many hours did I do my show? What was the income? Let's do the math. And does this still make sense? You know, and for me, it luckily enough, it has. You know, my show's been 100% supported. Actually, my income, you know, most people don't know this, even today, I still don't take a salary from Raw Voice because I truly believe in the ability of my show to take care of me and my family. And so I walk the walk and talk the talk. So, you know, that for me is a completely different, you know, that's just been, you know, my own self, the way I've operated from day one. We might get to the point here soon where I actually, you know, change that. But at the same point, you know, I think a lot of podcasters look at the time spent. They're like, oh my God, I'm not, and especially if they're trying to monetize, and it can become discouraging.
Yeah, and I'm going from the working on the whole Windows Phone side to going over to the content side with the Podcast One folks has been it's been a little bit of a flashback for me because I spent many years as a content provider with my own show and helping other people with their shows, and it is a lot of work. You know, I only have a kind of a fairly small piece of the overall pie. If the company, but you know, you just think about, you know, how much work it takes to do a real professional show and get it all set up and get the album art done and get the feed done and get it all submitted. I mean, we're trying to do, you know, I mean, we're trying to support, you know, a couple hundred shows and it's a lot of work. And, you know, we have a fairly small team. It's not a huge team. It's daunting, you know. I mean, I had it pretty easy working on the whole Windows Phone thing. You know, it was a pretty regular thing. But now being on the content side, which is more like where you guys are living, it's difficult to be a podcaster. It takes a lot of dedication, a lot of focus, and technology doesn't always work the way you hope it does, and that can be very frustrating. And I'm sure, I mean, all of us, if you've been in this space long enough, know that it's a very complex thing. I mean, even from feeds to you know, getting your show hosted and getting it into aggregators and now we're running into other issues of some podcast platforms, you know, like TuneIn and Stitcher and Swell, you know, re-encoding and redistributing shows and it's been, you know, it causes issues with breaking of dynamic ad insertion technologies. I mean, so there's just a lot of technological challenges to do this right. And it's been, what, 10 plus years now, and it's still a difficult thing to do.
Rob, if you're having trouble with your CDN or your feeds, I can help you with that.
Yeah, I know you can. Thank you, Todd, for offering.
You know, one thing, you know, a lot of the specific Raw Voice consulting is just helping people with issues, you know, and it runs the gamut of, you know, it's more like typical tech support stuff. And often the tech support stuff turns into, you know, a full-on maybe couple day consult or something like that. And We've just, you know, it's something that you love to do, but at the same time, you have to make a decision point on how much you actually do, because, you know, that really isn't our complete focus. Is, you know, we're into making sure that our tools work for the content creators, but we're not necessarily in the business of making podcasters, which Cliff is, you know, and I think that we need folks like Cliff in the space to continue to make podcasters, make good podcasters. And that's, you know, I think that's really, really important.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what Cliff does as well is he helps people in different genres of content that needs to be expanded and explored in the podcasting area. You know, it's not just tech or comedy. There's other genres that need to be expanded upon. And I know that's a big focus of the podcast one area too, is to kind of plow into different genres of content and build some audiences to pull in more female listeners, or to pull in, you know, the huge followings around the WWE or NASCAR or sports and all those kind of things that are huge in TV and radio. How do we translate that or transfer those audiences over to the podcasting space, which will help everyone, I think, in the space, if we can get more people aware of podcasts as a place to replace their radio listening, or to replace what they do, you know, on TV or even radio, if it's content that fulfills a need that they have or is a fan base. I mean, I see, you know, podcasts about TV shows becoming, I mean, my wife Dana was a very early TV show podcaster, you know, with the Boston Legal podcast. And I thought about it back in those days. It's like back in 2005 and 2006, back when we were actually doing that show, of building a network around TV shows, just like what we're seeing right now with AfterBuzz and those folks.
TV Talk.
Yeah. TV Talk is another one. And those guys are, you know, helping support, you know, that second screen experience, which I think has some legs, but it's really interesting that these new genres, I think, are going to propel this whole medium forward and build that huge scale that I think we all want in the space.
You know, you mentioned the WWE, J.C. Layfield and Michael Cole show. Two big WWE shows. You know, these guys, they understand, I think they understand the marketing part a lot more and the metric part a lot more than some of the other folks do. You know, they've been on our stats for a while, and, you know, they really are interested in digging in deep on how their content's being consumed. And they actually, you know, a lot of their content that they do, they specifically target, they know that they're getting an uptick on Stitcher, if they're getting an uptick on iTunes, you know, they're promoting that in their show as a place to go get the content, because obviously they say, okay, I'm seeing a little growth here, let me go and do that. So I think the, and I don't want to get into a metrics discussion, but I think some of these groups are very, you know, they're becoming very marketing savvy when it comes to learning how to build their audiences based on where people are actually consuming the content.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we are moving into a kind of a new level. I mean, it kind of feels that way, where, I mean, I get contacted by, you know, lots and lots of radio folks around the country that are currently doing podcasts, and they're not really monetizing those podcasts. Or their radio shows online. So it's there is a shift that's starting to happen with a lot of those either very popular local market personalities or even national syndicated guys that are looking at podcasting as another revenue stream and another way to connect with their audiences. And that's also going to pull in more radio listeners to our space. And I think it's all good. It may not be the traditional content that we all think of when it comes to podcasting, but there's a lot of people that are starting to think about radio and translating that over to the internet. As they get more gadgets and tablets and things like that, they would rather treat their radio show as an on-demand program. And podcasting kind of fulfills that versus them having to tune in at a certain time or to catch that show live. So I think we've all thought that this transition was going to happen at some point. But I think that the whole area, I think anyway, and I'm starting to see it happen, is the on-demand radio part. You know, as we thought about TV, on-demand TV and DVRs and those kind of things are it's part of a bigger trend. And I think that the audio space is kind of lagging in that, but I think it's happening.
Cliff, I don't know if you've run into any of these folks.
I'm seeing it.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when it comes to on-demand radio, I kind of see that happening for me with Spotify. I'm a Spotify subscriber. And one of the things that I can do in Spotify, of course, I can build my own playlist and play my own playlist. But sometimes I get kind of bored with the music that I've already previously discovered. So what I have found is that with Spotify, there's this browse feature. And they have these different playlists that have been curated for you. And they're playable on demand. And so it's not just the top 100 of the different genres, although those exist. But, you know, you can go in and play, you know, hey, here's for a quiet evening, you know, dinner music. Here's one for working out. Here's one for this. Here's one for that. And it's kind of like, you're subscribed or you're not subscribing. That's the difference, is you're not having this content delivered, but it is on demand. I can go in and say, okay, start playing this pre-curated, consistently updated, refreshed, renewed, predetermined music that fits the genre for me, and play it back to back without commercial. Well, of course, I'm adding without the commercial, but I love that. I love that I'm doing that, and so that I do love the on demand. And if I want to, I can pause and go do something, come back and hit play if I want to. All of that stuff. So I see not necessarily radio catching up, but I see on demand audio catching up.
You know, Rob, one thing that, you know, talking about the on-demand type stuff, is one thing we've seen with radio clients is that, you know, their sales teams are focused on local. You know, they have huge, you know, every radio station has a local sales team. And the challenge that these folks are running into, and radio stations are running into, is when they make that transition and they have their, you know, a lot of radio stations have, you know, I very rarely hear a radio station now that doesn't have a podcast, especially if it's a major one.
Yep.
You know, the challenge that they're having then is now you become a national show. Now you're nationally syndicated or worldwide syndicated, and their sales teams are largely made ineffective at that point because they can't put that advertisement in for the local tire changing place or whatever it may be. So that's going to be, you know, their big challenge. And you know, it's what we see is their, you know, that seems to be the number one discussion point that we have is, is that they can't put local stuff in, and on the reverse side, we've got people that come in and they want to do a hyper focused ad campaign to say they want to hit the LA basin, and I say, well, you know, and they talk about the volume that they want to do, and I say, well, you're going to have to buy, you know, nearly the entire podcasting space to reach, you know, a small portion of the LA basin, because it's not a, you know, it's not regionalized. This is, you know, you have micro audiences in every part of the country and world. And, you know, there's no one show that has a huge, you know, let's say for, you know, LA might be the exception, but, you know, then it turns into a, you know, is it worth it to even do this deal? Because it's going to cost me more to shove the ad into the content to make it regional specific. So, you know, that it goes both ways. You know, when someone wants to reach a regional segment with podcast, and you know,
but Todd, I think you have to be willing to, and I know that's what we're trying to do with Podcast One, is kind of push into that and to kind of pioneer more of that to build those audiences. I mean, I agree that if you look at like maybe any big metro area and you look at the overall kind of podcast consumption percentages, right? It's like, I think 22% or of the U.S. population has consumed a podcast in the last 30 days or something like that. So you think about the LA market, maybe it's 25% of the LA market consumes some podcast at some point. So, and that could be across, 100,000 different podcasts. So you just, that's part of building that overall audience, right, that we all need to do, that there's far more people listening to broadcast radio in their cars, right? Yeah. So that's part of what we have to do as an industry is we need to tap into those radio listeners and transfer them over to on-demand radio, which is podcasting. And that's where our future opportunity, and then helping those advertisers target to those geos so they can more effectively, we can blend this world of local advertising with national advertising. And try and make that work.
You guys are both very much interested in the advertising angle of this. And this is one of those areas for me as an independent content producer. I'm like, there's other ways to do this. And one of the things I'm not opposed to advertising. And that is one of the things that's interesting about the advertising space in podcasting is, any independent podcast producer that has a niche podcast, if you have, let's just say, a wedding photography podcast, and you have, only need about 2,000 or 3,000 subscribers. If you have 2,000 or 3,000 subscribers to your wedding photography podcast, it is not a problem to develop a good sponsorship relationship or an affiliate relationship or even an advertising relationship where you can communicate that the value of your 2,000 to 3,000 subscribers is far greater than actually taking your same product that's trying to reach the photography clients in your area where the podcast content isn't necessarily devoted to that. We offer something much greater than trying to broadcast your message. We're narrow casting your message targeted to exactly who you want to reach. And that's where I think the real benefit of the niche podcasting comes in. And I hear a lot of talk about people who want to expand their audience to hundreds of thousands, and there's nothing wrong with that. There are hundreds of thousands of photographers out there, and I'm sure there are almost that many wedding photographers out there. So sure, grow your audience, but I don't necessarily see that the advertising thing is the main focus, at least from the independent side of things.
One thing that I've seen, Cliff, is that, the challenge I have with most affiliate marketing programs is they really, the majority treat the affiliates like crap. They give them a very small token payment for a product and service. And this is one of the reasons why when we introduced our affiliate program at Raw Voice is that we did a two-tier affiliate program where, number one, the individual is going to get, and I think this is a model that I wish a lot more companies would do because it would make you more endeared to them, is that, number one, you get that reward for bringing that client to the company. And number two, if you bring a lot of clients to the company and build volume, there's an annual bonus for the person that does that. So we write our plan is we want to write annual checks to all of our affiliates for, number one, bringing us the business, number two, being loyal and bringing us more business, and number three, what that really ends up doing is I've got a partner now. And, that partner is going to want to work with the people that they brought to our business and make sure that they're successful. And that in the end, everyone continues to rise up and and everyone is promoted. The whole model behind affiliate marketing is there's no risk to the advertiser, because doing all the work. But I think that the high majority of affiliate programs, it's a one-time shot, and having a successful affiliate program, I want something more of a closer relationship with the affiliates. That it's not a one-time shot; it's a lifetime relationship over the length of that account.
Yeah, I totally get where you're coming from, and certainly you want to pick and choose the affiliate programs that you're a part of. Certainly, there are a couple one-time shot affiliate programs that I'm happy to be a part of. I won't mention any names, but there are hosting companies that will pay. They start out at $65, but it's not hard for you to get to a level where you're getting paid $150 every time somebody signs up for, let's say, a hosting account with a hosting company. That's one. I just signed up for an affiliate program with ADT. I just created an amazing podcast episode about why my wife and I chose the alarm system that we did. And ADT pays $125 for each person that signs up. Now there are some that actually pay a lot less money per sign up, but it is this ongoing thing. So for example, AWeber email marketing, they actually give you a percentage of income as a lifetime ongoing basis for the account.
Yeah.
FreshBooks does the same thing. And so there are these things where I pick and choose who do I affiliate with? And I make those decisions based upon, number one, how much do I love the product? How much does it fit with my, and all of those things. And I think those are great relationships. And even more so, and here's the thing, just because a company does not have an existing affiliate program doesn't mean that you can't create an affiliate relationship with those people. And this is where, like I said, if I'm not a wedding photographer, but man, if I was a wedding photographer, I would go to companies where I'm purchasing specialized products that help me do my wedding photography business in a way that takes it to the next level, and then work out an arrangement and say, listen, let's find a way for, if every time you make a sale from my recommendation, I earn a generous commission of $200, you know, and let's work out, how do we do this? And you can even, as the content creator, work out how does this get tracked and stuff like that. And the big thing is, and of course, as a content producer, this means that you're not only in the wedding photography business and you're creating a podcast, but you're also becoming a sales and marketing guy as well. And you're helping them. And so there's, like you said before, there's a lot of work into doing this if you want to make money from it, but it is possible. And I believe that, again, with 2,000 to 3,000 people, you can actually make a lot of money per episode from those kind of relationships. And just a lot of people are not out there pursuing that.
You know, I attribute to the reason why we did the two-tiered system to something I did back. Well, this is, I think, Rob, I don't know if I told you this on the last show, but in the early days, when you remember when we had to pick a dial one, most folks aren't even going to know what the heck we're talking about. Remember when you had to pick either AT&T, MCI, or Sprint, you had to pick a long distance carrier. Remember those days?
I do.
Well, I sold long distance. That was my, you know, that was what I did for a part-time job for 2 or 3 years. And I, at the time, I was selling MCI, and I think MCI paid me like $45 per new sign up. And there was a whole shell game that was played to make sure your application was the last into the PUC. And that's a whole episode in itself. But I made more money on the residual income. They paid me a 10% of everyone's long distance bills each year. So, you know, basically at the end of the year, I got this, well, actually each month, I got 10% of what someone spent on long distance. So even though I got 36 was great, you know, you think about someone that had a, back in the day, where people actually had large phone bills, and not like today, a $240 phone bill earned me $24. And you multiply that over, you know, let's say, and we were very successful. We did about 25 to 30,000 signups for MCI. That paid very handsomely over about a 10-year period. So that was my goal in bringing a two level, because MCI rewarded me for the business I brought them on a continual basis. And it was incredible. It really was. And I think if more companies did that, their affiliate programs could be much more successful. Absolutely. I know we've had great success in just the 2 weeks we've been going. It's been pretty explosive already.
Yeah, I think that also one part of the whole affiliate marketing thing, and it is very similar to the direct response kind of advertising that's going on too, is that somehow it needs to be taken into account the brand benefit, and I know that, you know, to build a revenue model, I mean, it's great for the advertiser to get paid for results, right? But you're also driving, brand just awareness. Like in TV and radio, you're driving a lot of brand impressions and brand placement in a very personal way in their ears, involved in a relationship with a with the show and a host. And that has value, long-term value to that brand, though it's not being taken into account in the kind of affiliate deals or the direct response ad buys. And I'm not sure that that's fair to the advertiser. I mean, this is an issue that I struggled with back with my own radio show, back in the early days of podcasting, even when I was on broadcast, was this whole thing of that advertisers wanted to evaluate me based on the same model as a sponsored link click.
Right.
And it's just not that way. I mean, and that's not the complete picture. And I think that a lot of advertisers are getting a lot more value than they're paying for when it comes to affiliate marketing or direct response advertising.
Hey, Rob, just real quick, you said you didn't think it was fair to advertise. I think you meant to say that it wasn't fair to the producer of the content.
Right. Yeah. No, that's right. That's correct.
I think everybody knew what you meant, but I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I don't think it's fair to the content provider necessarily, but it is about driving value. And I know that the podcasting space is a little bit of an experiment for a lot of these companies. But I also know that there's proven cases. You know, you just talked to Todd, you know, his relationship with GoDaddy is a proven case of successful relationships in this space and long-term branding and how that can drive, you know, tremendous kind of performance. I don't know, Todd, you can speak to this more than I can.
Well, you know, my relationship with GoDaddy is performance-based, but I have a significantly loyal following that renew their products every year, basically because I get no benefit from the renewals. I'm based on the number of new customers. My performance is based on the number of new customers I bring to them every month. But at the same time, I also understand that there has literally been, you know, quite literally tens of thousands of people that have signed up for a GoDaddy hosting plan because of me. And so when it comes to, you know, I would try to get renewal codes for them. And they've been a little less willing to give renewal type stuff, but I tell them how to get discounts. You know, I tell them, okay, if I can't provide you a renewal code, you know, call them up on the phone and say, I'm renewing, I want a discount, and they'll give you one. In having the direct connection with the company, if someone's had a big issue, you know, I have a connection with the office of the president. I can go right to the top and say, hey, you guys screwed up here. So for me, the relationship with the vendor is as important as the, you know, product I'm giving to the, you know, the product endorsement I'm giving to them, which they have sponsored. But, you know, I use the product and I believe in the product. And when they screw up, I'm not afraid to tell them that they have, and sometimes publicly. But at the same exact time, you're right, Rob, it's been July of 2005, they have advertised in 932 episodes of my podcast. And, and obviously they still feel it's worth it because they're still renewing the contract every year. So, but you're right. I think that's just one use case, but again, I'm still performance-based, but I think they understand the value of the long, you know, what happens, what's the message that's sent if they don't advertise my show? Ooh, what's going on? But at the same time, all the brand awareness stuff that's going on is happening in television. There's no brand awareness campaigns that are not, you know, everything I've seen so far come across my desk this year has been performance-based. You know, you have to perform, you have to deliver new customers. But, you know, there's the majority of advertising spent on television is brand awareness. Billions of dollars is being spent on brand awareness. And we're not getting even, you know, not even a percentage of that taste of that money and flowing in the space. But, you know, and I know, Cliff, that you guys do, you know, one-on-one relationships. I think that's really important. And like you said, you're building a, you know, you're having the podcaster connect with someone in the space that matches exactly their product, and building their own affiliate programs. I think that's really, really smart. But sadly, a lot of companies don't have the infrastructure in to track, you know, each sale. And that can be a challenge too, because I've seen some great opportunities and they just had nothing in place to track you know, a sale that would be coming into them. So then I guess you just have to be creative to figure out how to do it.
Hey, just one more thing. And Todd, then I have to pretty much head out of here. I got my wife upstairs. She just brought me some lunch. But one other thing that I've done, just I think since it's along this line, one of the things that's been extremely successful for me, you know, obviously I'm a podcast consultant and coach. That's my business, you know, but even if I wasn't a consultant and coach, one of the things that's obvious is that if I was just podcasting about podcasting, I could have an affiliate relationship with a B&H or somebody like that, or even share Amazon links. But one thing that is extremely profitable for me is I worked out a reseller agreement for a major professional audio equipment company. And what I did is worked out an arrangement where they give me a directly reduced cost, because I told them, I said, I'm going to have lots of orders that come through you. And what they do is they give me a price and say, this is how much it is for each of this equipment. And then they ship that order blind without any of their company logos or anything to my client from their warehouse. And they send me an invoice net 20 days. What I do is I advertise the entire package at my price and sell it directly to my client. My client pays and buys the product. I then take the order. Actually, my assistant takes the order and send that to my supplier, and my supplier sends it. And I mean, I'm very open and honest about what I make. It's actually just went up to $366 for every podcast Answer Man equipment package that I sell. So somebody buys from me, they give me the money immediately. I give the order to my supplier. They ship all the equipment to my client, and they send me the invoice. I pay them, and in the end, at the end result, I have $366 for each one of those packages that I sell. That's a whole lot more than average, affiliate commission, and it's something that can be worked out in a number of other industry and niches out there. You could do it with tennis rackets or whatever the case may be. Special packages of hard sale equipment. You can work out a ship arrangement where you're a reseller of somebody's goods and you do all the work on your end. You're just their client and they ship the stuff and invoice.
The drop ship method is fantastic. And, you know, luckily enough, you've got the volume now that you can actually do that deal. Many times these vendors require a certain volume, and you hate, you know, because I've tried to do some of these deals in the past too. And they're like, well, if you can guarantee, you know, they make you sign almost like a guarantee that you're going to move X thousands of dollars of equipment a year to do the deal. And if you can get a deal where they don't, and I don't understand why companies don't do that, you know, if they've got a good drop ship mechanism, I guess it really works out for you. I think that's important. So, that's cool. It is.
Just different ideas. If nothing else, I know that, I communicate this kind of stuff all the time, but since we were on this monetization topic here, I just wanted to give people some ideas out there.
So I know you got to go. Where do you think the space is headed?
Oh, dude, I'm so excited about podcasting. I really am. I kind of predicted at the beginning of 2013 that 2013 was the year that podcasting was really going to go to the next level as far as recognition among average, ordinary, everyday people. And I definitely saw that. Just the number of people who are going to conferences and talking about podcasting, and I'm talking about conferences that have nothing to do with podcasting. People are texting me and they say, Cliff, I'm here at this conference in this medical field and we're talking about this, and they just brought up the topic podcasting, thought you would like to know. So it is definitely prevalent. The smartphone has made it easier than ever before to get a podcast. Anybody who is a content creator, if they have any desire to take podcasting as far as its exposure and awareness to the next level, if you just take some time to grab your friend's Android phone and their Windows phone and BlackBerry phone and learn how on all the different kind of devices are out there, then when you're having conversations with people, and if it's all the topic of podcasting, why not teach them right then, right there, what a podcast is, and I can find one that would be of interest to them. I think it's easier than ever before. I do see a lot of people, like Rob was talking about, I am reaching people who are branding out. I've got pharmaceutical companies who are actually thinking about podcasting, who are actually creating podcasts, and they're reaching their existing audience, the people they're already aware of or that they already have on their mailing list and already have on their client list, and they're
teaching those people about podcasts. It's really exploding. It's really growing. And I think that if you guys keep a Google alert out for the term podcasting, I think you'll see more and more mainstream coverage even this year. So I'm very, very excited about it.
Rob, any final questions before we let Cliff roll here?
No, I just want to say that I appreciate all of his work that he did at the New Media Expo over the last, what is it, 3 years, and I'm glad to see that he's kind of refocusing his business and but continuing to be that advocate and that kind of spokesperson for the space, and I really appreciate it, and just want to say thank you, Cliff, for all the stuff that you've done to help bring in a lot of really, really compelling shows to the space, and I wish you the most luck in the future, and hope to see you at the podcast movement, because I plan on being there as well.
Ditto for me as well. And Cliff, keep up the good work, and I'm glad you were able to navigate that minefield. I think before you took the position over at New Media, I told you, I said there's going to be, everyone's going to have an agenda. And, you know, including me. So I'm glad you were able to navigate that minefield. But thanks for everything you do as well.
Thank you. Yeah, guys, I definitely want to come away from this and just say overall, my experience with New Media Expo was an extremely positive one. And I'm incredibly thankful for the relationship that I have with you guys and everybody else I got to know through that experience. And man, I tell you what, the days are bright ahead for all the things related to podcasting, on-demand audio, online radio, all this other stuff that we're creating out there to get our message out to the world. What an awesome privilege we have to communicate with the entire world with no gatekeepers. I absolutely love it. And it's only the beginning of what's going to come in the future. So I look forward to being on here again very near in the future. And thank you for the opportunity today to talk with you guys.
And make sure everyone goes over to podcastanswerman.com and check out all Cliff's stuff and get signed up for one of his courses and keep him in business. Thanks, Cliff. We appreciate it.
See you guys.
Thanks.
Okay.
One thing you can be counting on, Rob, is Cliff is always upbeat and motivated in the morning. I've never heard him with a downbeat attitude ever.
No, that's right. You know, I mean, he's a cheerleader for the space, and he's always been that way. So, and I really, really like that about him, you know, from the, you know, a couple of years ago when I joined him on his show and talked about the whole Windows and Microsoft kind of podcasting platform. And I've been always impressed with his show and his kind of quality of his production. You know, his audio quality, and he's got a great kind of radio voice too. So, yeah. And it really, really creates kind of a personal friendship kind of feel to his show. And it was always really impressive to me. I think he would be a very, very successful broadcast or radio guy as well if he ever went on that side of the fence. But it's interesting. He's a good guy.
Do you, I know that you've got to get on the road here in a little while.
That's all right.
No, are you packed and ready to go? And how's your wife handling you being out of town a lot? Is it, you guys dealing with it okay?
Yeah, I think we're dealing with it. It's a little bit of a transition for us, but, our relationship has been, we've had a lot of, things that we've tried and experimented with and worked, in different ways. We're just, this is kind of a new kind of direction for me somewhat, to hop over to the content side again at this level. And I'm just, I'm going to ride this out and see, where it goes. And it may be a really, really great place to be in the long run. So as far as, what I'm working on and what I'm focused on trying to do, it's different than working at Microsoft, that's for sure. So it's more, back as a startup, and it takes me back a good decade, right? Back during the whole .com boom, and even my work at Melodio, working on back in 2005 on a mobile app So, you know, kind of that startup environment, you know, where everybody's like running 100 miles an hour and trying to get stuff done and kind of really, really stretching themselves. And it's a lot what you've been doing for many, many years.
So, any ideas who we're going to have on next week? I know that you ran out of time last week to kind of do some recruiting, but any thoughts?
I think I don't really have anybody booked yet, but I'm, you know, there's certainly a bunch of people that I can think of that I could probably invite, you know, so I'll let you know.
All right. Sounds good. Well, folks, we'll be back here next Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern. And we're already pretty long today, so we'll get out of here. Everyone, thanks for listening. If you have comments on the show, you can email it to either Todd or Rob at newmediashow.com. And we appreciate any feedback you had. I don't know if you saw it, Rob, but we got some someone's pitching us a little bit for Goner glasses.
Great.
And not for advertising. They want us to wear them. So we'll see how that goes. But, you know, and folks that listen to my regular show will laugh because I wore Gunner for about 3 months trying to entice the Gunner folks to advertise on my show, and they never did. So
it's
kind
interesting.
Of, yeah, it is kind of funny.
So are you using your Google Glasses much anymore, or is it kind of a passe thing now?
I have, let me see here. I actually have the frames. And
oh, you do?
Yeah, so I've got to get the prescription put in them. And I've just been, they've been sitting here for, you know, a month, and I got to get them over to the optometrist to have the frames put in, and then I'll get them mounted up, and I'll be wearing Google Glass a lot more.
So, yeah. I started using a Surface.
Right. Are you?
It's a Surface Pro is my primary work computer now. So
how's that working out?
It's actually working out really good. You know, it's got an i5 processor in it, and it's pretty lightweight and compact for, you know, how powerful of a computer it is. So. It actually is really, really been an interesting experience. I didn't have one when I worked at Microsoft. I used a different computer back then.
I'm surprised you haven't got sucked into an Apple down there.
I had an opportunity to do that, but my ramp up on that would have been a lot longer.
Yeah.
Because I've never used a Mac, so yeah. I just didn't need to add that to my complexity, where I had to learn a whole new operating system, plus learn as fast as possible about a whole company. So yeah. I just stuck with what I'm familiar with for now. I would love to get more involved in the Mac operating system and be more ambidextrous in my kind of OS world. And I do have a Android Nexus 7 that I use. And it's mainly I have an iPhone now too, which is really, really handy because we have a, you know, Android app, and then we have a, you know, an iOS app for Podcast One. So I have to be able to test and get access to those things. So, so I am really kind of cross-platform in a lot of ways. I just haven't gone down that rabbit hole of a Mac laptop or anything like that.
Well, let's get out of here so we can get everybody on to other things. Everyone, thanks for being here. And we'll see you next Saturday. Until then, take care and aloha.
Bye.